We turn in the Word of God to 2 Chronicles 22. In the midst of all the chaos, bloodshed, and evil that is all around us, it's easy to overlook the heroes. They are often hard to find. And why is that? Well, sometimes God's greater work is actually hidden from prying eyes. To give you an illustration of that, 2 Kings 4 and verse 4, you know the situation of this lady. And she comes to Elisha and she tells him how little she has. And he says to her, go borrow these vessels, the vessels abroad of all thy neighbours, even empty vessels, borrow not a few, and when thou art come in, thou shalt shut the door upon thee and upon thy sons, and shalt pour out into all those vessels, and thou shalt set aside that which is full. A reminder that often God has a secret work that no one even notices or knows. I'm sure tongues were wagging, why is she borrowing all these vessels? But the door's shut, they can't get in to find out. No one's answering. But God is doing a work away from prying eyes. You see, we sometimes think that if God does anything, we have to tell everybody. Tell everybody everything. Forgetting that sometimes God does a work that's not for public consumption. Hence our title this evening in relation to this chapter, God's subversive work. God's subversive rule, perhaps, might be better. Let's note, first of all, in verses 1 to 6, the wickedness of God's enemies. Ahaziah, who had been so remarkably preserved in the previous chapter, I suppose we think, well, will he not now have an interesting life? Will he not have learned from that remarkable providence? And will it not make an impact upon his life? So we might read the chapter in great anticipation. We might say to ourselves, shouldn't that providence make an impact upon his life, upon his thinking, upon his heart? So we note the following things here. We note, first of all, a pitiful beginning. In verse 1, there is no public ceremony. No prophets and priests have called to install this man as king. Rather, you have what is surely a quite pathetic installation with a reminder of all the bloodshed that caused it. There in verse 1, the Arabians had slain all the elders. But even that bloodshed is a reminder. God does pay back in the same coin. Remember, Jehoram slew all his brothers, and God came and slew all his children. He paid him back in the same coin. God is, after all, a God of justice. Here is a lone survivor who learned nothing. And that's a tragedy, isn't it? He learned nothing. And the second thing you notice in verse 2, a short reign. Look at verse 2. He was 42 when he began, and he reigned 1 year. One single year is all God gave him, and not a day more. And sadly, it was long enough to reveal his own wickedness. He gave him sufficient time that everyone could see the rottenness of the human heart, the wickedness of this king. And you'll notice thirdly in verses 3 and 4, the dominion of evil. Tells us at the end of verse 2, Athaliah was his mother's name. He walked in the ways of the house of Ahab, for his mother was his counselor to do wickedly. And in verse 4, the house of Ahab, they were his counselors after the death of his father. So Athaliah, the daughter of Omri, of the house of Ahab, she was his advisor. She was telling him how he should live, the course of action he should follow all the time. Her worldview became his. Hers was the house of Ahab. So she passed on to him the same outlook on life. He walked in, we are told, in the ways of the house of Ahab. Verse 4 says, wherefore he did evil in the sight of the Lord, like the house of Ahab. And you get a hint of what is to come at the end of verse 4. To his destruction. So God says to you and I who read, there's a warning of what is to come. And fourthly, you will notice, following on from that, verses 5 and 6, the path to destruction. At no time did he stop to think. At no time did he reconsider. At no time did he ask. You know, in this man's life, God did not exist. God is not there from the beginning of his reign. He lives a life without God. But he is quite enamored with the house of Ahab. And as Jehoshaphat sadly did, so did Jehoram. And as Jehoram did, so did Ahaziah. Verse 5, he went with Jehoram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, to war against Hazael, king of Syria. And the Syrians smote Joram. Notice the striking providence. We should always take note of providence. Not walk blindly through life as everything just well happens and is almost superfluous and irrelevant. We note the providence. We note the wounds that were given, the gathering at Jezreel to recover. Fascinating providence. Nobody knows what's going to happen. But they all just simply gather at Jezreel, hoping that, well, if we stay here for a while, you know, one will recover from wounds in battle and then we'll all go off home. And that's it. But they do not know what's happening. Ahaziah, king of Judah, went to Jezreel. Jehoram, king of Israel, went there too. Now, at this moment in time, the names can all get confusing. And that's why, you know, if you like family trees, it all works out very well, but if you don't, well, it all gets confusing, because at this precise moment in time, you have the king of Israel and the king of Judah, and they actually both have the same name. But the king of Judah has a couple of names. Now, you remember in the previous chapter, there were two sons, both called Azariah. And to distinguish him, one gets an extra name, Ahaziah. But of course, he is also called by the same name as the king of Israel. This can get confusing. That's why this man has so many different names to distinguish him from his brother Azariah and then from his cousin who is ruling up in Israel. It's a bit like someone, they have sons, they call the first one Robert, then the next one gets Robert James, and then the next one gets James. So they have to distinguish. So the first one gets Bob, the second one gets James, and then when they get the James, they call him Sandy. You know, so they try to distinguish the one from the other. And of course, if he's got a cousin who's also called Robert or Robert James, then they have to add something else. And that's what happens here in order to distinguish. And so you'll notice the subtle change of names. Ahaziah, Azariah, tells you who belongs to whom. So there they are, gathered. The same name, the same heart, and the same walk. And they're all in the same place. They're wicked. All of them. Secondly, the punishment of God's enemies, verses 7 to 9. At this precise moment, despite all that's going on, we think, where is God? And we begin to see that God is actually always at work. The destruction of Ahaziah was of God by coming to Joram. God was at work from an entirely different angle. Remember Elisha as God's prophet in Israel, whom God sent to anoint Jehu to be king over Israel, who began to systematically wipe out the entire house of Ahab. And it's just one bloodshed after another. He's having a great time. He is knocking off left, right, and center. He is killing people here, there, and yonder. And he thinks, I'm doing the Lord's work. Well, that is true in a sense. He was indeed doing the Lord's work. Notice here a couple of things. The first thing you will notice is the plan of God. The destruction was of God. A plan that was revealed to begin with in the days of Elijah. Then, of course, it is repeated in the days of Elisha. In 1 Kings 19, verse 15, the Lord said unto him, Go, return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when thou comest, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. Jehu, the son of Nimshi, shalt thou anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, shalt thou anoint to be prophet in thy room. And it shall come to pass that him that escapeth of the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. A plan fulfilled then in the days of Elisha. 2 Kings 9, verse 1, Elisha the prophet, called one of the children of the prophet, said unto him, Gird up thy loins, take this box of oil in thine hand, go to Ramoth Gilead, and when thou comest thither, look out there at Jehu the son of Jehoshaphat the son of Nimshi, and go in and make him arise up from among his brethren, carry him to an inner chamber, then take the box of oil, pour it on his head, and say, Thus saith the Lord, I have anointed thee king over Israel. Then open the door and flee and tarry not. This was, if he was caught, a death sentence, but he sent them to do it, and the young man did it, and he followed the warning, the exhortation. A plan was being followed. God's plan was being carried out. So you have the plan of God. Second, you have the sword of God verses 7 to 9. Jehu is God's instrument in smiting the house of Ahab for all its great sin. And Ahaziah, at that point in time, is part of that house by birth and walk. And there are three comments here that humble us. The first comment is, they buried him. The second comment, because of Jehoshaphat. And there's a comment about Jehoshaphat, a reminder from God, who sought the Lord with all his heart. God keeps setting before them the standard, the example. And in this contrast we are seeing, here is a king who did not follow that example. The way God blesses is the same way that Jehoshaphat walked. And the third comment is a sad one. Ahaziah had no power to keep still the kingdom. At that point, we surely conclude, if there is any decency left in the world at this point in time, it's shown actually by Jehu. Because he has the person buried out of memory to Jehoshaphat. But at this point, godliness seems to have ended with Jehoshaphat. So that's why this is here in this particular verse. It's as if, as we look at the whole situation, we simply conclude, godliness is finished. The kingdom is finished. There is no hope. There is no future. It's as if providence has torn the promise to shreds. Remember the promise that we looked at in the previous chapter? Now it looks as if, well, the promise is gone. And on that note of seeming despair, where we have the providence of God, rebellion against God, retribution from God, punishment from God, we now see, thirdly, in verse 10, the fury of God's enemies. Athaliah, in her mad fury, she seeks out anyone who in any way is in the bloodline of the house of Judah. It's a seek and destroy mission. Here is a woman of the house of Ahab, connected to the royal line of Judah, living in Judah, doing her best to wipe out the whole line of Judah. It's as if she wants to ensure the promise will never be realized. She will wipe out the promise of God to David. Now, if the curse of God hangs over history, I remind you, the promise of God remains through history. Chapter 21, 7, howbeit the Lord would not destroy the house of David because of the covenant that he had made with David, and as he promised to give a light to him and to his sons forever. So we have to ask, does the promise still remain? Where's the promise? We have just seen the demise, it seems, of the house of David. It seems the last king from the line of David has been killed. And this dreadful woman is trying to extinguish anyone that's left. Does Athaliah succeed? Now, ironically, all that she's doing, they all brought it upon themselves. You think of Jehoram's genocide, chapter 21, 4. Philistines and the Arabians went further, chapter 21, 18. There is only Ahaziah left, 22, 1. Now Athaliah hunts down anybody, anywhere who's left. So was that it? If God slew Jehoram, if God slew Ahaziah, can God even preserve and keep his promise? You see how dark the whole chapter has become? Everything's getting darker, everything's getting worse. And just at its darkest and blackest, we note fourthly in verses 11 and 12, the subversion of God's enemies. And the hero here is this lady, Jehoshabeath, the daughter of Jehoram, the sister of Azariah. So let us pause here and wonder. Let us, in fact, salivate over this remarkable incident through this woman who just suddenly seems to appear from nowhere. In the very house of Ahab is a believer. Remember, Paul said there were believers even in Caesar's household. In the strangest of places, we shall bump into believers. We note her bravery, her cleverness, and her determination. It required all of that to do and maintain what she had done. In verse 11, she took Joash. She stole him or carried him away. She put Joash and his nurse in a bedchamber. She hid Joash from Athaliah. And in verse 12, she hid Joash in the house of God. And she did it for 6 years. That's a long time to hide someone and to keep it all quiet. Nobody knows. Right under her very nose. In the one place you would not expect. In the one place you did not go to. God's promise of a lamp is being preserved. How exciting, how thrilling, how exhilarating. But all seems so dark and so gloomy and so black when there's nothing but death and destruction all around. God is doing a work. Using an unexpected person. Remember what these 6 years are like. From the parallel in Kings, we know it's a reign of terror. But hidden from sight is that subversive work of God. That subversive rule of God. Right under her nose. God has done something special, is doing something special. Is it not similar to the birth of Moses? You know, there's a dark side to the providence, isn't there? As well as a bright side to the providence. The bright side of the providence, Moses is preserved in such a supernatural, remarkable way. But you know, the dark side we don't often think of. For no other mothers did the same happen. Countless other infants were slain. But God does a secret thing. He is subverting everything, altering and changing. Let's come to some points of application. First of all, I simply remind you that when all is dark, remember God's secret work. Our default position is, you know, give us the thunder, the lightning, and the earthquake. That's what we want. You know, we want to see the fire from heaven. We want to see the prophets of Baal slain. That's our default position. And we forget the still small voice. We forget that secret work of God. And God seems to delight in the small, in the obscure, in the unexpected. You know, you see that through history. You know, you think of Luther. I mean, he is a nobody. He's just a monk like all the rest of the monks. But what changed? God convicted him in his heart. That's all that happened. He did a supernatural work in his heart. And that's what led to the Reformation, wasn't it? You know, you think of Calvin. You know, Calvin's great plan for himself was, I'm going to get out of France. I'm going to travel to a nice little corner of a city, get myself a nice little apartment, and there I read and write. And what happens, you know, all these armies suddenly start fighting each other. Calvin says every road he was on, there's a clash of arms. Every road he takes is blocked with warfare until finally he's on this road into this city and he meets this crazy person. He calls down the curse of God upon him if he doesn't stay. You know who it is. He wasn't that crazy, but you know, it seems, you know, it just seems so odd, doesn't it? You bump into this guy you've never met. He demands you must stay in this city, or God curse your life and your labors. Think of David and Goliath. You know, the world admires Goliath. He's so strong, so huge. Even the Israelites are afraid of him. And along comes David. Oh, he wants, what's going on, chaps? And as he's there, he sees Goliath coming. Sees everybody in Israel afraid. And he says, we can take this guy. And the brothers say to him, you know, you just go back home and look after the sheep. Leave it all to us guys. You know what happens? Saul hears about it. He sends for him. He thinks, if I can suit him up to make him bigger, look stronger, look mightier, you know, and send him out into the battlefield. And David throws it all off. You know, Goliath gets the point. Goliath gets it better, I think, than some evangelicals. He looks at this whippersnapper. He looks at this young guy. Do you think you're coming out to face a dog? You know, you think you're... Who do you think you're going to fight? David knows who he's going to fight. But he knows something more than Goliath. God's going to kill you. And astonishingly, this young man, you know, with that sling and a stone, Goliath falls. But don't forget the training. All the years that went behind it, out of sight, out of mind, irrelevant. What is Goliath? Just another bear? That's all it is. When all is dark and gloomy and depressing, as they say. Let us not fall into that way of thinking. Let us rather wait to see what the Lord shall bring to pass. Secondly, safe in the house of God. You know, we sing this so often, perhaps we forget what it even means. For example, Psalm 27, verse 5. In the time of trouble, he shall hide me in his pavilion. In the secret of his tabernacle shall he hide me. He shall set me up upon a rock. If Psalm 84, 1 to 4, Psalm 91, verse 1, he that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. You know, our English word sanctuary meant a place of safety. So if you were pursued by the crown or by someone else, and you got inside a building that belonged to the church, you couldn't be arrested. You literally claimed sanctuary. You were safe. And that's the idea here. But God is the sanctuary. That's the point. We have lived through an interesting providence. We Christians have professed, oh, we are saved. We are ready for death. And this little virus comes and suddenly everybody's afraid to die. But we sang these words. We have sung these three psalms. That our trust is in God. God is our refuge and our strength. In straits of present aid. Therefore, although the earth remove, we will not be afraid. We sang that, didn't we? As our fathers of old sang. Psalm 46 was Luther's favorite psalm. He would sing it to himself, you know, when he got discouraged in his darkest days. He pulled out Psalm 46. Sanctuary. Safe in God. Safe in the house of God. Safe with God. Remember the apostle on that ship, facing shipwreck, says to the sailors, all the crew, God whose I am and whom I serve. That explains everything as far as Paul is concerned. Now this is what we're going to do. We're going to stay in this ship and we'll be safe. We'll all be safe. Throw off the ship, whatever you like, but stay in it. And they were safe. Thirdly, sadly, the consequences of Jehoshaphat's folly. You know, this downward spiral that we've been reading of, it began actually with Jehoshaphat, sadly. Giving his son to Ahab's daughter in 2 Kings 8. Next, he went into battle with Ahab and barely escaped with his life. 2 Chronicles 18, nearly killed, God delivered him. Then he enters into an alliance with the king of Israel. 2 Chronicles 20, that ended badly. So the pattern was set. God slew Jehoshaphat's son, Jehoram. God slew his grandson here, Ahaziah. And he's going to kill his great-grandsons too. In other words, the folly of one generation can have a devastating impact upon the generations afterward. And we see that in church history. You know, we see it in the worship of the church. One generation decides we're going to innovate and We're going to be the cool generation. And the next generation follows the same argument. The generation that decided in the history of Presbyterianism in Ireland to ditch the regulative principle, that generation, I'm sure, would be astonished to see Presbyterians nowadays following an Anglican church calendar with their Christmas and their Easter and all of the rigmarole and the bijouterie that has been brought in. I'm sure they would be astonished. The impact of the folly of one generation. And fourthly and finally, Christ did come from the house of David. He did come from the house of David. The lineage in Matthew and Luke confirms God kept his promise to David. On the one hand, as we know, there is Athaliah, who wants to destroy the promise, to cut off the promise. And on the other, interesting, these two women, face to face in the last section. One woman wants to kill everybody. And the other one knows the promise. Will keep the promise. Will be used to ensure the promise carries on. Two different people, two different plans, two different actions, two different women with two different hearts. Athaliah, ungodly. Jehoshabeath, married to Jehoram, or Jehoiada, the priest, working and living in the house of God with her husband, keeping the promise. Who wins in the end? Does Athaliah win in the end? Not at all. The promise is fulfilled. Christ came into the world. And the one place you didn't look is the house of God. And where did Christ come? Where was he brought? He was brought to the house of God. So fascinating. The way everything is put together by God for us to see. That we might admire him and magnify him. Christ did come. And he will come again. The promise of the coming of Christ shall be fulfilled. And you shall see Christ with your own eyes. That's part of the promise too. So no matter how dark and gloomy things may be in our world, God is always at work. Even if we can't see it, we don't always need to see it. But we shall be recipients of the impact of God's work. May the Lord bless these words to your hearts.